I was fortunate enough to be born into a fishing and hunting family, so I got started when I was in diapers. My wife, she decided that we needed a bird dog. About the time my dogs hit 3 years old is when I decided that big game hunting was nice to do, but bird hunting was a requirement. That's when I really put the big game on the back burner and started chasing birds a lot more.
You're a big game hunter, you get the bird dog, clearly get the itch. When did the writing get mixed in?
I never thought about publishing anything until I started bird hunting. My middle dog, Yuba, was the catalyst for it. She was born with very severe hip dysplasia. We had some issues with the breeder and trying to talk about the breeder's guarantee, basically how that breeder treated us and kind of told us that it was our fault that dog ended up that way. And so when I realized just how well the information sharing worked out, and one thing just led to another, it's like I'm already writing stories about bird hunting.
I tried to not miss an opportunity to ask Western ruffed grouse hunters about Western ruffed grouse cover. So talk to me a little bit about sort of an ideal place where you're looking for ruffed grouse.
That's a good question.
Come here, Emmy.
Hey everyone, Nick Larson here, host of the Birdshot Podcast, the show that brings you conversations, stories, and traditions from all across the uplands. The Birdshot Podcast is presented by Onyx Hunt and supported by folks just like you via our Patreon community. If you want to stay up to date and not miss any of our upcoming episodes, be sure to subscribe and follow the show in your podcast player or on YouTube, wherever you're listening or watching today. Tap that button for me. Thank you for doing so. And with that said, let's get into today's conversation on the Birdshot Podcast. Freshly paged through, and we're on the Birdshot Podcast, and I'm excited to be joined by author of Wing Shooting the Palouse, Brad Trumbo. Thanks for joining me today, buddy.
Yeah, thanks, Nick. Thanks for having me on.
So, out west, now I just read the book. Washington?
Yep.
Okay. What is the Palouse? It's in the title of your book. You know, I try to refrain from like hot spotting on the show, that sort of thing, but it's the title of your book, so I'll let you describe it.
So it's kind of like this Eastern Washington and kind of into the Idaho Panhandle region. I live down in the southeast corner, south of the Snake River. And if we're really talking about Palouse proper, we're kind of talking about a little bit north of me, but it's this really fertile agriculture area. It's just got a lot of cultural and geologic history to it and whatnot. But it's this beautiful place that's a mix of grasslands and a little bit further north, you get into, you know, mixed pine stands and again, agriculture. You know, there's a lot of different grains that are grown out here. So it's just this really neat, rolling, fertile region of the area.
So lots of agriculture, lots of grasslands, and apparently we're in wind turbines as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. they seem to grow like wildflowers around here.
Now, you are obviously an author. We'll talk about that today, but you're also a biologist, right?
Yep.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about that and your background.
So I was fortunate enough to be born into a fishing and hunting family. So I got started when I was in diapers. That's just something that I was passionate about, you know, and it's interesting to me how families can have that scenario, but not everybody carries the torch. I've got family members who don't really care for the outdoors, and then somebody like myself who lives, eats, sleeps, breathes it. I knew before I was probably 10 years old that I wanted to have some type of an outdoor career, and I was a bit of a fishing nut as a kid, so that's kind of where it fell. And partially because you know, poison ivy allergies were pretty severe. I was like, well, I guess I don't want to be a forester. And anyhow, you know, times change, people change, interests change. I got my degrees in fisheries. I came out to the West to do fish passage research on the Columbia and Snake River dams. And that has evolved into me working in the public lands management side for the federal government. So it's been an interesting transition. And it was very fitting because where I'm from back east, we didn't have hardly anything for upland birds. You know, I think I killed one ruffed grouse in Virginia in my youth, and to see them was a treat. You know, I didn't really think about shooting them. Coming out here, suddenly I've got Hungarian partridge and ring-necked pheasant and, you know, valley quail. And if I go to the Columbia corridor, I've got chucker. This place is full of stuff. So once I got into the bird gig, then that easily led me into more of a land management desire.
I definitely picked up bits and pieces of that story. Some of it, I want to draw on that a little bit more because you talk about how you were at some point, you know, I definitely resonate with, you know, getting an early start in hunting. I was exposed pretty young and my brother was too. I've got a younger brother and the bug just did not bite him in the same way as, like, for me, it was one day in the woods and that was it. Like, there was no turning back. And, you know, he enjoys the stuff and fishing more so, but not so much on the hunting side. And it's just, again, it's sort of the deck deals a little bit differently for each person. And
yeah, it's really interesting
as well. But yeah. So, but anyways, it's eventually you got into big game hunting. And if I'm sort of pulling on the story correctly, like, you were really a big game hunter when your life led you to the West. And at some point upland came in, but talk me through that a little bit. I mean, you were kind of, you know, chasing big bucks and doing all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. It's kind of serendipitous. You know, we had plenty of whitetails in Virginia. And so once I graduated from gray squirrels into whitetail hunting, that's, you know, my biggest draw out here was mule deer. And I still am just infatuated with mule deer. You know, so archery season, muzzleloader season, those were the weeks or months that I lived for. And then my wife, right before we were married, she decided that we needed a bird dog because I don't know what I was doing. I was out with a buddy and ended up shooting my first pheasant because we were driving to a site to do something and a bunch of pheasant ran across the road into some brush on public land. And it's like, hey, it's bird season. So we jumped out and kicked up a pheasant and shot my first bird. And my wife was just like, hey, I think you need a bird dog. And I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about, but okay. You know, so about the time my dogs hit 3 years old, that would have been around 2014 or 15, is when I decided that big game hunting was nice to do, but bird hunting was a requirement. So that's when I really put the big game on the back burner and started chasing birds a lot more.
Yeah. Now there was something in, it was like a, you didn't, it wasn't like a full essay on it, but it was kind of a passing comment about, maybe it was just that serendipitous suggestion from your wife to get a bird dog. How did you get your first one? Did she like go buy it or something?
Yeah, I leave a lot of that stuff up to her because I'm very easy to please. So yeah. For me, it would have been like, oh yeah, setter looks good. You know, whatever, you know, talk to some pheasants for everybody's. Cause of course they've got English and Gordons and whatever else. And everybody's got a Vizsla and GSPs. Yeah. But she is very particular about things. And so when it came to having a dog in the house, she did a ton of research and decided that Llewellyn temperament is what she was going to be okay with. Okay. So she's responsible for me having all the dogs that we have, I have to say. She was the one who wanted to make that decision. I don't know if she realized that it was going to stick her in a quagmire of having a dog for the rest of her life, because now now we're in it. So
yeah, getting a puppy is one thing, but yeah, projecting ahead the next few decades is
yeah,
a little different. That's indeed. Funny. You're not alone in that, though. Obviously, that's a fairly common sentiment. The significant others having that influence. In fact, I finished Wing Shooting the Palouse. Now I just cracked open a book that I've been wanting to read for a long time. It's been sitting on the shelf. I think it's The Tattered Autumn Sky by Tom Davis. I have not read that yet. And I'm like two chapters in, and already he's got a good sense of humor, and he's got some comments in there about his wife sort of like controlling the number of dogs he can have and all that sort of stuff. So
yeah,
it's funny. Comes with the territory. I'm in that mix right now. I'm getting a pup next spring. I think I can say that officially on the podcast. If all goes nice, according to plan, I will have another dog next spring, and I may have three. Hartley's 11 years old. He's doing well right now, and we're still hunting, so might have three myself next fall.
So what breed are you thinking about?
I am going right back to the well, so to speak, and getting another English setter from Northwoods Bird Dogs, Jerry Coulter. And
good call.
Betsy Dennis. Yeah, I feel so fortunate to have stumbled upon Jerry and Betsy when I did, when I knew literally nothing. And yeah, I've learned a ton in the last 11 years. And man, the dogs that I have are, obviously they're family members, like just about everybody here listening, you know, would echo that. But they're so nice around the house. They're great in the woods, and they mean a lot. They're really, really nice dogs. So I have not even really thought about getting one from somewhere else yet. So
yeah, nice.
I've got the setter bug. I mean, I know I talk about it on the show. I'm always tempted by, you know, the Britneys and other things, but when it comes back to actually getting that next pup, I haven't been able to really, really think too seriously about anything else.
I'm not sure if I can either. You know, I really like a good Vizsla. I know a handful of folks that have Vizslas that are great dogs, and I'm always happy to hunt with them and whatnot. And it's like, hey, it would be nice. I think honestly, my next dog is going to come from Paint River. Kyle Warren.
Oh yeah, okay.
Has a very similar bloodline to what my first setter came from, and I just love the dogs that he has. And I don't know when the next one's coming. My youngest is 8 years old. My 11-year-old is...
The youngest is eight. Okay. Yeah.
My middle dog, the 11-year-old, she is starting to go blind. And I didn't notice that until a month or two ago. It hasn't been a problem in the field yet, but her capability is clearly going to start going downhill. And the 13-year-old, she is... she's hunted, and we actually had a pretty good hunt for quail the other week, but finding birds isn't all that big on her list. She's just happy to go out and romp around. So it's hard for me to get used to the fact that the young dog is going to be the only one very soon, possibly next fall. Because she is such a wild card. Like, that dog has uncanny skills, but her personality is such that pointing birds is not what drives her heels. I have to just get used to the fact that...
Is that one of the dogs I read about? Like, would that be Yuba or...
So that would be Zeta. She's the young knucklehead who's just, I mean, the dog has stamina and energy and agility for days, but she doesn't have any patience.
So. Yeah. You know, that's interesting. You mentioned your 11-year-old going blind, because this is new to me. You know, I have not had a bird dog through its entire life yet. Obviously, Hartley's 11, but he started noticing this last fall that last fall, I would describe it as I was suspicious that his hearing was starting to go, you know, his directional awareness of where I am, which I don't know how the dogs keep track of the way they do in the woods as, you know, as it is. Like, I don't know how they do it. It's amazing. But now when he's not at that level, like, I can tell he's looking for me and he's going the wrong way, that sort of thing. This year, I'm definitely noticing it. His hearing is... His ability to track me is like, I can whistle at him across the room and he hears me, but in the woods and he's got a bell on and that kind of thing, I've got to keep him, you have to keep closer tabs on him. And I'm trying to, this year I've been trying not to put him in, trying to like manage his, not put him in real rugged covers, rough stuff, lots of terrain. You know, I have so many covers around here, like I can kind of pick and choose where I want to put him. And I'm now thinking like I would do well to keep him on a trail also, because the other day we went off, and this time of year the woods are really thinned out, you can go anywhere, you know, the woods are in peak condition, but without that trail to key on me, he's just more likely to kind of take a cast out one way and then he's just not able to come back to me. And we haven't had any like real big separations, but you know, he's 190 yards that way and I just know that he's not trying to be that far away from me because he doesn't really do that anyways. But so I'm noticing that. I don't know what you do other than you have the GPS collar and starting to think about that. But the eyesight that's another one entirely too.
Yeah. And that's not really what I anticipated. You know, for a while I had Yuba's mom. She was, we rescued her and she was 12, I think, when she died, but she died from a brain tumor. And that dog, when we got her, we had had some other apparently malignant tumors removed from her. You know, she had some health struggles, but her eyesight never seemed to be an issue, although her eyes were really milky in her older age. Yuba's eyes are pretty milky too, but it's very obvious that she's having a hard time seeing stuff like small movements and whatnot. I had her out looking for pheasant the other day in kind of tallish cover or whatnot. I think she can still hear fine, but she can't necessarily, you know, I would figure if I'm standing there, if I'm moving or if I'm waving to the dog, that she should see me. And I'll see her looking up over the grass and she's looking a completely different direction, a whistle or something, and she'll turn right and come straight to me. Like she just can't see me. So
yeah,
that's going to be challenging. I don't have any real dangerous covers around here, and she's never been capable of chucker hunting because she doesn't have any hips. So she's not been stable enough for that kind of country, but now I have to keep her out of super heavy cover and, you know, just trying to keep her in earshot.
Yeah, I'm a little bit kind of like I was with this hearing last year. I'm kind of wondering about his eyesight this year too, because his eyes are a little milky. I talked to the vet about it when I brought him in this summer. And there's just been a few moments, kind of like what you're describing, where it's like he's down the road. Maybe he was just separated from me and I'm kind of looking in, and like, I kind of have to do like a big arm wavement to really get his attention. So I'm starting to see that as well, but aging bird dogs, and that's comes with the territory. And we've had some great hunts. Like it's really, you know, every time I go out there, and I'm really trying to remind myself, like I'm here in the woods another day that I've done so many times with this 11-year-old dog. I mean, we've had so many days afield, so everyone feels like another bonus at this point, you know.
For sure.
Where are you guys as far as like the, you know, are you in the heart of your season? How are things shaping up out there?
So the season's fairly long here, fortunately. They're a little bit staggered, like rough grouse. Well,
you got such a mixed bag out there.
Yeah. And so in Washington, the forest grouse season opens in September 15th, and that runs through January 15th. And then early October, the quail and partridge seasons open. And then end-ish of October, I think it was the 18th this year, is when pheasant opened. And so quail, partridge, pheasant, they run through approximately middle of January. And then chucker goes through the end of the month, end of January. So there's a fair amount of time. I need to get out and make sure to hunt grouse a little bit more before the season ends this year. That's something I always have to remind myself, you know, once quail and partridge season opens, I like looking for huns and, you know, pushing the blackberries and whatnot, because we have so many valley quail in eastern Washington. It's a good time hunting those birds, but then it's like, oh crap, it's still grouse season. I should get up there before it snows too much.
Yeah. Does your forest grouse season does it end on you based on the calendar, or do you kind of get more snowed out of the covers?
It depends. There are some creek bottoms where I could hunt the whole season through, but some years we'll get enough snow that it's just too, I mean, for me, it gets a little too slick. Like if we get a heavy snow and then it warms up, and then that'll end up packing in, and next thing you know, we've got it's like an ice slick all the way into the covers. I don't go into that. Some of the mountaintops that I hunt, sometimes by this time we've already got, you know, 2 feet of snow up there. I haven't been up there yet this late in the month, but I noticed driving into work yesterday that we have some pretty nice snow caps right now. So I might be done with the mountaintops for the year.
Yeah. Yeah. It has not been the case for us in the last few years. I mean, we can very easily get snowed out of the woods just because our seasons go to December 31st, or actually I think it's January 1 now in Minnesota, and then Wisconsin's a few days later, which is where I'm typically hunting those two states. But you know, you could get a pile of snow. In fact, it wasn't too long ago, sometime within the last decade, I remember I don't think I grouse hunted after like November 19th or something. But the last few years been hunting right towards the end, because we haven't had that snowfall. But it's always in the back of your mind, like, man, this could just be taken away. If we get 2 feet of snow, like that's when I'm probably, I keep saying it, but I probably would at that point. If that happens, that's when I would be looking at planning a little trip somewhere to extend the season.
Yeah, and I've got a couple of low elevation covers that I need to get into right about now, because when the weather turns, you know, even though it's kind of rough to hunt them, it's under a pretty heavy evergreen canopy. And so when there's snow in the trees and whatever, and it's kind of like temperature melting conditions are always borderlined in there. So it's pretty wet. It's pretty gross. But when you get that bad weather, I've found a bunch of birds that have moved down into some of those covers. So it's hit or miss, but when they're in there, they're in pretty thick.
Yeah. Now this is a good problem to have, but do you have the problem of like, you've got your, you know, some of your favorite spots that you are trying to save for like when the conditions are perfect, but then you run the risk of not getting in there?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
It happens. And you know, I think most of the time I end up waiting too long, and if I can make it in there, then it's just the birds just aren't there because it's not, you know, conditions aren't quite right anymore.
That's been a theme for me the last couple of years, and I mainly due to just the amount of exploring and discovering new areas that I've done over the last 11 years compared to what I used to do. So again, you got this laundry list of places to go, which is great, but then you can only hunt so many of them the last week of October and the first week of November when you want to, and then the timing's perfect and everything. But right now we're in a good spot. We have a really stable weather pattern, and it has not been getting really cold at night. And I mean, it could certainly change fast from here, but it looks like we're having this real gradual kind of descent into late fall, winter, that sort of thing. So conditions are right now, and I imagine a lot of people are out there chasing birds and having some
fun. Good stuff.
I want to ask how you kind of got into writing, but there was, before we leave this entirely, there was a thing in there about, might have been Huns. It was either Huns or quail, but you were still big game hunting. You were eyeballing this like giant whitetail buck, and was it a covey of Huns that actually spooked the buck from you?
I am almost 100% sure it was a 6x6 typical whitetail that was, I mean, I'd never seen anything like it in all my years, you know, growing up in Virginia. And I was hunting with a buddy, and we were driving out this precarious, probably shouldn't have been on it, mountaintop road, because out here the soil is really fine particulate and just greasy. And we had one of those mornings where you get on it and it's frosted, right? It's hard and everything's great. Yep. And then when things warm up and that top inch or so melts off, like it packs the tires and it's like you're on ice. So anyway, that's later. We were cruising out this mountain road and, spotted a dozen or more whitetail does out on this bench off on the mountainside, and they, you know, stopped the glass. And next thing you know, we're turning up this buck that's bedded there with them. So we just drove out the ridge and went a couple ridges over, hiked down around, we're coming back up under them. And this was steep stuff. It was taking us a while. I mean, we figured the deer were just going to be in there and it wasn't a big deal. And I was probably, there was a basalt rim that I was going to come up beneath, and the wind was going to work for me. I was going to be within about 30 yards of that deer when I popped around through, you know, just through a little crack in the rock. And I was like, this, holy crap, this is going to work. I must have been 30 yards from that rim, and there was an old balsam root that had, you know, died, so the leaves were crackly, and I think I stepped on that, and a dozen partridge blew up between me and that rock. They walked up there, and the deer were 150 yards away. I was like, son. Man.
How much did you hate the Huns at that moment?
I was a little bit disappointed, let's say.
Okay.
But it was really, really neat to see those birds, because, you know, something like that, I don't remember a ruffed grouse ever blowing a still hunt for me in Appalachia.
Yeah.
So it was news. Yeah. Like, I wasn't even thinking about that. So
yeah. Yeah. You were laser focused on 6x6.
Yeah.
Yeah. So do you still do some grocery shopping with the venison, that sort of thing? Then you're
I do
bird hunting.
Yeah, I still have the desire to hunt archery, but I got into a target panic issue with it. I probably quit archery hunting at least 5 years ago, just because I didn't feel confident enough with it. Wasn't able to overcome my issues. But I'm going to pick up traditional archery at some point.
Is that kind of like I'm not super familiar with that. I've had this sort of desire to get into archery. I have a bow, but is that like getting the yips if you're a golfer or something? Like, what is that?
Yeah. Okay. So for me, the issue was, I think it came from having wounded a few deer and not really understanding why. Like, I lost a whitetail one day that was a 10-yard broadside shot with a bow. I mean, it was like you could do it blindfolded, and somehow I screwed that up. And there were two or three years where something dumb like that just happened, and I was just like, nope, I'm good. When I was just practicing in the backyard, it got to be like, if I were trying to put my pin on the bullseye on the target, getting the pin on the bullseye was a really hard deal. And so it's like, I'm not gonna go out there with my bow if I can't stand here and just drop that thing where I need it to go. I shouldn't have to be like trying to mentally compensate for my own inadequacy here. So yeah, so I quit.
Yeah, man, when you put it that way, I could definitely, everybody listening probably knows what it's like, you know, that feeling you get if you knock feathers off a bird and you don't recover it. Like that happened with the archery hunt. I mean, I could certainly see how that would lead into that.
Yeah, and it's really like it stinks to hit a deer and know that it's not necessarily a fatal wound. You know, yeah, it's going to hurt. They're going to have to heal from it, whatever. It's worse to make a bad fatal shot and know that it's going to be a long deal for them to before it kills them, you know. And that's, I just can't stomach that.
Yeah, actually the last deer that I killed, I've not killed a lot of deer in my life. I'm less than 10, whatever it is, but I was fairly confident. It was something that I really enjoyed doing, just rifle hunting. And all the deer that I had killed up to that point were pretty much, you know, one shot, good vital hits, and deer were down. Nothing crazy ever happened. But the last deer that I killed, I had a good shot, but it was the biggest buck that I had ever really laid eyes on and killed. And so I made this shot that was maybe a little longer than I had shot before. I'm talking like less than 150 yards for sure. Nothing crazy, but for a Northwoods deer hunter, it was a shot. And I took that, and just the way the terrain and the topography set up, fortunately, this deer, I hit him, and then he came towards me and kind of came towards my stand because there was a lake behind him and he didn't really know where I was. You know, it's rifle hunting, that kind of thing. And basically gave me another gimme shot that I was able to take and put him down. And it wasn't until I went down there and got and field dressed it that I realized that my first shot was way off from where I thought. I think I hit him in the liver, like really far back. I'm assuming I pulled it, just totally underestimated that he was out there and I needed to take my time and focus a little bit more. And I did not. And fortunately it worked out, but I just kept thinking like, man, you know, that's one of those bucks that, you know, he's liver shot, he's going to disappear and you're never going to get it back. Like I think about if that scenario played out differently, I would have been in a very different way knowing that I lost that buck.
Yeah. I've had really good rifle success over the years. I've very few times have I had to shoot twice or whatever, you know. One time, there's a really nice whitetail buck that I kill in Idaho. I had a 220 yard downhill wide open shot and I was just far enough back that, like you were saying, I think I caught him pretty well in the liver, but didn't get any other vitals. And so this deer, he was in full rut. And so he took off after his doe and went way up this mountain ridge. And luckily he cut across kind of like an opening and I was ready for him. And it was, I don't even know how far the shot was. I was just shooting an old 243 and I put the crosshair up on the back of his neck and ended up shooting him in the heart. So it was a bit of a lucky shot, but I dropped him up there. So that was nice.
Well, apologies to the listeners for a little deer interlude there, but it's October 30th here. So this is the time of year where the deer hunter in me comes back, you know.
Absolutely.
I have yet to see it, but a big buck could walk by us at any point here.
Yeah. Looking out that back that window there, that looks like a fine stand spot to me.
Yeah. It's if only I could hunt here. This is the city limits. There's a city deer hunt, but I don't think I would qualify here. I'm a little bit too crowded by my neighbors, but there's a 600 acre park this way. And then this is basically behind me, like where this office is a little finger ridge that comes off of that. And that's a flat spot right up there. And the deer are back there all the time. And I don't see the bucks really much of the year, but from here on out for the next month or so, they'll be back there. And then they bed back there in the winter.
But yeah. Nice.
It's fun. Yeah. Anyways, when did the writing get mixed in? You know, so you kind of, you're a big game hunter, you get the bird dogs and you clearly get the itch. And again, of course, encourage folks to pick up the book if they're interested in Western hunting and some of the stories, but when does the writing and that stuff start coming into play?
So I'd been dabbling in creative writing for a long time. I actually had, I took some classes in college and just really enjoyed it. I never thought about publishing anything until I started bird hunting. And my middle dog, Yuba, was the catalyst for it. She was born with very severe hip dysplasia. And so like at 7 months old, she was coming up lame, just playing in the yard. And we got her some x-rays. And of course, you know, veterinarians are like, well, we don't, you know, don't really want to diagnose that for sure in young dogs, like so young. But there really wasn't a question when you looked at the x-ray. She just didn't really have any sockets on her pelvis. So it was pretty obvious. We had some issues with the breeder and trying to talk about the breeder's guarantee and how, like, how that breeder had treated us and kind of told us that it was our fault that that dog ended up that way. And so there was some stuff went down there, and I was like, I think people need to know what's happening here. Because it was not something, that scenario was not something that the breeder was going to be honest about with their other customers. So I just wrote up a short story.
Suggesting that you ran her too long or too hard or something like that?
No, they were suggesting that we fed her the wrong food.
Oh, geez.
We didn't have her on a very specific raw diet or whatever that this breeder said we needed to have her on. And therefore, the dog's health problem was our problem. And my wife and I are scientists, and so we're like, well, here's actually peer-reviewed literature that says something different. But that's neither here nor there. I wrote up a story about Yuba's first rooster just for funsies, submitted that to Pointing Dog Journal, and they accepted it. And after it published, folks were looking at us up on Facebook and whatnot, and we were having conversations with other people who were going to buy from this breeder. And it was really interesting to me to see how just providing, and in this story, it was really just focused on this dog and her hunt and whatever. And all I did was slip in, this dog has severe hip dysplasia, and her full registered name tells you where she came from.
Sure. So
then we started hearing from other people that are like, we're having a problem here. And what about this? And so when I realized just how well the information sharing worked out, and then that kind of was like a foot in the door for the broader upland bird community, one thing just led to another. It's like, I'm already writing stories about bird hunting because, we all get sucked into the magic of working with our pointing dogs or whatever, and the birds themselves and the covers and just the whole thing. Right. So I thought that it worked out pretty well with Pointing Dog Journal. So I tried another journal, and then one thing led to another. And I don't publish in too many magazines. I think I got three-ish stories in this year, but I've got newspaper columns. So that's kind of like the routine gig. And then I fit in other stuff when I have a chance. There is another book that's going to come soon. I was just talking to my wife last night. It's like, I've probably 80% there with everything I want with it. I just need to sit down and outline it and lay it out. And then I'm going to publish it myself. Use that as the opportunity to go through the process on my own through Ingram and get it all set up and whatnot. Because that's kind of what I want to do in the future with my small business.
Okay. I just was checking the copyright on this one. 2022 for Wing Shooting the Palouse. Did you work with a publisher on this one?
There is a group called Kiyoki Books in Northern Idaho that helped me get that thing set up and published through Ingram. And so it's still, a self-published book. They were just the experts for getting it laid out. And I had a really good experience with them. But it was one of those experiences where I think that I can do it myself if I just allow myself the time to do it. So I want to learn that process. And then, maybe that'll be something I can do in the future. But I kind of like the idea of being my own publisher.
Sure. When did, I've interviewed a lot of authors on the show, and I always love this. I don't typically get into this, but you kind of got me curious. When did it become writing essays and publishing in different places? When did the idea come, like, I should put these together in a book? I mean, I think that's kind of natural for some people. They do a lot of writing and they'll oftentimes pull together a collection of work and make it a book. Was that the case for you, or is it a little different?
No, that was the case. I think that most of what I published in the book had gone to another outlet at some point, but there's always, always a handful that nobody's ever seen before that you want to keep for something like that. And it's the this next book that I have in mind is actually going to be more of a species specific book. I'm thinking about writing a valley quail hunting book, but I'm wanting to meld some styles. I'm wanting to, you know, include essay, include information, and go heavy on photography. And so kind of bring a whole bunch of different aspects together in something that's a little bit, has a little bit more depth than my essay book, like Wing Shooting the Flues.
Yep. Okay. Yeah. There's a lot of things that your biologist background shines through. I love when writers or anybody really talks about kind of, you know, the geological history of an area. It's like, you know, you can kind of cast a wide, you know, there's dogs, there's birds, there's guns, there's landscapes, all of those elements. I think at different times in people's up and hunting pursuits, kind of maybe you're really, really interested in one of those more so than a few others, but you really wove a lot of that stuff in. I just love the descriptive stuff about the landscape and pulling all that together. You're clearly very observant out there, and I will go out on a limb and say you're willing to romanticize a bit about kind of the, you know, the landscape and the beauty and all of it. And I love that stuff. I love building that up in my mind.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's exactly what it is. It's a romance with upland bird hunting and landscapes. And one of the things that I published in, I think it was October 23, when Raconteur magazine was out there, I published a 4-part series called Etched in Stone, and it really wove in the cultural and geologic history of Central Washington and how it was even formed through a bird hunt. And that's really the kind of stuff that drives me. Like it fascinates me to see things like petroglyphs and pictographs, you know, if you're say up Hell's Canyon and then what folks share from some of the Central and Southwest, you know, all of the secrets and stories that this landscape holds and everything that it's seen. It enamors me.
Yeah. Is that that series, is that available somewhere, like on your website? Or
I don't recall if I I probably have a link to it somewhere on the website.
Okay, if you think of it, and I'll remind you after the show, I would just love to read it, and I'll throw a link in the show notes. But I just that geological stuff and the natural history of the landscape is right up my alley at this point. So
I'll send you a link to that.
Appreciate it. I did read an article. You had an article this summer or early fall in Covers magazine about, I meant to pull that out before our interview here. Apologies. I did not do that, but it was something about ruffed grouse hunting in Washington and kind of like a hunter survey thing, right? There was sort of a unique thing that they were doing. Were you like filling out cards in the field, or remind me of what that was about?
It was based on my experience and the recent history of harvest data that I had access to. And so Eastern Washington, to me, like maybe I give myself too much credit when I go out into a cover and I'm like, there should be birds here and there's not birds here. And why is that? You know, and I start thinking about, is it a habitat thing? Is it a numbers thing? Like what's going on here? And in Washington, it's grouse management is like, I wouldn't even call it that. It's just passive, right? So they take wing and tail data to understand population demographics, and they take harvest reports to understand how many birds are being killed. And kind of the litmus test for are we doing okay is what does harvest look like compared to past years, for example. And so I really wanted to look at the trends and see what was going on, because nothing has really helped me understand environmentally what makes a good year versus a bad year for grouse numbers here. And I really don't know what to think about long-term trajectory other than the numbers are declining. And you can clearly see that in the data. The hunter days and the birds harvested are all going down in the past, you know, 15-ish years. I can't remember how far back I was able to get the data without going to the state. You know, just pull it offline. So I just kind of wanted to share what that actually looks like here. You know, there are fewer hunters, there are fewer birds, but if you look at something like number of birds harvested per day, that's staying about the same. So it seems like the bird numbers and hunter numbers are both declining proportionally. But it was just interesting for me to distill some of that information, you know, from out of my own curiosity and share some of that through grouse hunting in Eastern Washington.
Yeah, and I suppose, you know, cycles don't get brought up much to Western rough grouse hunters. You know, that's some we talk about here in Minnesota and a little bit in other areas, but it's, that seems to be very Great Lakes focus when we talk about, I shouldn't say the ruffed grouse cycle. I think oftentimes as bird hunters, we talk more, you know, their upland birds are cyclical in nature as like an in general thing, but are there any other like culprits that, that people might point to, or, you know, is it the logging or the forest practices, anything come to mind?
Other than maybe some pretty major fires and whatnot, there hasn't been a lot to really point to. Part of, one of the things I looked at that I don't recall if I even mentioned it in the story or not, because it seemed inconsequential, was precipitation. You know, if that data was aligning with good harvest years or whatever, and I really didn't see anything worth talking about. So maybe because nobody is really studying what's going on, you know, it's all just, there's not really a way to pinpoint it. And I, looking at the data, I'm not seeing a very obvious population cycle that you would expect to see. I mean, and maybe it's just because I don't have that kind of detail to do the statistics on it or whatever. Yeah, it just seems like it's all questionable.
Yeah. I try to not miss an opportunity to ask Western ruffed grouse hunters about Western ruffed grouse cover. So talk to me a little bit about sort of an ideal place where you're looking for ruffed grouse out there.
I would say in my experience, in a dry climate, mostly. If I'm within 300 feet of water, you know, let's say I've got a nice creek bottom cover, and not necessarily something like a spring seep or whatever. I've got an actual perennial flowing water and enough of a riparian area that I can actually hunt it. That's where I would like to target. There are usually birds in those areas. Again, it's hit or miss. You know, whether I find them or I don't, they are there somewhere. I just probably didn't get into them that day. But those covers are where I've seen the most birds in a hunt, hands down, time and again.
Yep.
Where I like to hunt the most is up on the top of the mountain. The covers are more open. They're brushier. There's a ton of like snowberry and elderberry. Schooler's willow grows out here. If I'm remembering correctly, that's got a food source to it.
Okay.
There's a bunch of small, large, small fir, you know, so you get a stem density, you got a food source variety, you've got a mix of evergreen and deciduous. And that's those edges and those food sources are where I find grouse a lot in fall.
Yep. What kinds of stuff tend to line those drainages? Are we talking hawthorns, mountain ash? Like, cause I feel like the thing that comes up a lot are those drainages and those creeks. And there's usually fruit-bearing shrubs associated with that stuff.
A couple of things that are pretty ubiquitous are serviceberry, snowberry, and
oh, yeah, serviceberry. Okay.
So those, you know, kind of those three. I mean, you'll even find some of the elderberry in those riparian zones. I find the elderberry more on the mountaintops, but the snowberry and rose hips are pretty much everywhere. And, but the creek bottom covers that are forested they're usually full of cottonwood and,
okay.
They have a mix of, you know, fir, pine, whatever, evergreen that I guess those birds use them more for shelter.
Yeah.
And then once the elevation starts to rise on the flanks, you get into your serviceberry and that'll move up into grassland, mixed pine.
Okay. Yeah. It's, you know, I mean, being close to water is, I don't think that's ever really a bad idea, no matter what the surrounding condition. It's dry in our woods right now. And so it's one of these things where like, I'm usually trying to be pretty close to a swamp edge, no matter what. And that's not really that hard to do. Specifically in Minnesota, it's a little harder in some of the areas I hunt in Wisconsin because they're a lot more sandy and dry, but well-drained soils. But the other day I had probably my most productive hunt of the season from a flush count perspective, and you know, conditions are perfect right now, so that maybe played into it. But it was also, this is one of my better areas in the last 5-6 years. Just everything's just right. I mean, they cut a lot of it in, you know, 10 to 15 years ago. So there's that, But then it's like this, it's kind of like this peninsula. It's this forest road that goes in. It's this peninsula of high ground, and kind of on all sides, it falls away into like cedar swamp. And cedars are great, you know, heavy cover for the birds. And I was where I hunted, I got Hartley and we got into that cedar edge right away. And right away we were into birds. And
nice.
You know, were they there because we were there, or were they there because that's where they all were? I don't know exactly, but I've moved a lot of birds on those cedar edges over the years, and they were in there this year too. So yeah, those water sources, there's increased diversity. There's usually sunlight. You get all that stuff there.
Yeah.
As a biologist, you know, the importance of just the diversity of habitat. That's what you're looking for.
Yeah, for sure. We had talked a minute ago about romanticizing the upland hunting and, you know, and the landscapes and whatnot. And I have to say, when I hunt mountaintops, it is 100% about landscape. You know, there are covers that I hunt that I almost never see a bird in, but I hunt them just because I like them, you know. And some of those covers, I know the birds use it, and I can go 2, 3, 4, even 5 seasons and not find birds in there. But sometimes, you know, it coincides just right, and I'm like, holy smokes, there's grouse here, you know.
Yes.
So yeah. And that's the conundrum for me with grouse. When I hunt a cover that seems to have everything, it's got all the food, it's got the varieties, it's, you know, why are the birds not there? It could simply just be a matter of timing that I'm in their home range, but they've got so much, you know, that they can pick and choose from that it just went all, you know, how many times do I have to go before our paths cross?
Yeah. I love that about bird hunting. I suppose you could make it what any hunting, but I love that too, because there's areas where I go to hunt where I'm really choosing like the aesthetics and the hike that I'm going to have through the woods versus do I think I'm going to flush the most grouse possible here? No, not necessarily. There's some areas where that I love to hunt that are kind of like these long, shallow drainages that just, there really isn't the cutting that you would normally be looking for as a rough grouse hunter here in the Lake States. But those drainages always have hazelbrush, and they have these openings and these grass, and there's mature aspen. So they have a food source, but it's really easy to hike through. I mean, you can just kind of move through it and weave. So you're not busting brush like you normally would be. And there are some years where you really are conceding grouse flush counts just to go hunt there.
Yeah.
But knowing that you've got a chance to get a bird pointed, right?
Right.
But I have had other years, kind of like you're talking about, where, oh, wow, there's something, you know, everything came together, and now I'm hunting like my favorite cover, and there's a pile of birds in here.
Yeah.
So that's like hitting the lottery.
Yeah, for sure. Usually when I find a spot like that on the mountaintops, it's the birds are, they know it well enough, and they know how to escape. And one evening in particular, I was hunting the spot where the top of the mountain just dropped into a deep canyon that looked, you know, looks like chukar country. And we got into the grouse really heavy that evening, and I had no expectation that was going to happen. But all of those birds were super wily, and they were getting up ahead of us, and they were just bombing down over that ridge into like these deep snow brush draws, well out of gun range. But they acted a whole lot more like chukar than grouse that day.
Yeah. That reminds me of a hunt I had, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago in this spot. I was kind of described as one of my places that I really like to hunt along one of these drainages. And one thing I like about it, this is what I've noticed, is that I feel like if you get a rough grouse pointed in an area that is more open, where it's maybe, say, it's mature timber and you got patches of hazel brush, but you're not in the broomstick aspen where it's really thick everywhere, I feel like a lot of times if the dogs come up on them quickly, they'll hold, because they know that they don't have a protected escape route. So oftentimes you get some of your most thrilling flushes and dog work. And this basically happened. We're walking along this drainage, and my dog, Rose was close, and she went on point. And anytime the dog goes on point when you're like, you know, within 50 yards, the excitement level goes up, because it's like, if you get on a grouse that quick, like your chances of a good flush are pretty good. So anyway, she goes on point, and I've got basically my choice of how I want to, I've got 360 degrees of how I want to come in on this. In hindsight, I should have just walked right in, and it probably would have worked out. But instead, I tiptoed around her. I went all the way down. I put myself down on this edge of the drainage. So then I was kind of looking back up, and I was kind of thinking I would push the bird up and away from us. But sure enough, this grouse was like 8 feet off of her nose, and it held as I walked all the way around. You know, this is all in a very small circle, and the grouse flushed really low right over my dog, just in the only place it could have gone that I couldn't have got a shot off. And sure enough, that's what it did. So tip my cap to the grouse. And I mean, it was still a great contact, but you got to love that.
Yeah, they are sharp birds. I've had I've had those come up like within feet of me hunting in some of the thick willow and, you know, undergrowth from old burn scars and whatnot. And we've gotten into bird after bird after bird, and I've never seen one of them because they get up. If the shrubbery is right about eye level for me or higher, and the birds get up in front of me, they don't, they stay just above that brush line, you know, however they can glide through that stuff like a Star Wars fighter. And I never see them, you know, and they just sail out of sight.
Yeah. I mean, they're living on surviving and escaping. Yeah. So it shouldn't necessarily surprise us, but it never ceases to amaze you when you see them do it.
Exactly.
Before I wanted to ask you about, like, you know, natural history and the landscape stuff. Is there like, how do you research that? Like, is there a place where you go to look at that? Or I'm kind of thinking out loud here, but I'm like, I should be looking up I know there's a book on the Northwest Sands in Wisconsin that a friend recommended it to me. I want to read that, but like a Minnesota geological history, is there like a book on every state, or where would you go to learn more about that?
That's a good question. Usually I end up with questions about like, how did this come to be? Or, you know, thinking about the Central Washington basalt formations and whatnot, it's like, how did it end up being this way, right? And I've always heard stuff about the Missoula floods, for example, and how that shaped a lot of Washington. And so then it's just starting to Google things and looking for literature on it. And, you know, there's always a book or something somewhere out there, but there's a lot of resources that are just available online that are, if they're not peer reviewed, they're at least, you know, factual accounts of what happened and whatnot. And so I just start basically typing questions into
poking around
into a browser and seeing what comes up, and then start reading into the information from there.
Okay. Very cool. Do you do like, thinking about going back to your essays a little bit, do you do journaling, field notes, that kind of stuff? How do the stories get put down on paper?
That's a good question too. Cause I got a hunting journal, and that's more for, you know, what was the brief, the down and dirty, how many days, where were we, what were we doing, what was noteworthy about it, etc. But then the stuff that's like whatever was particularly interesting or unique or what have you ends up going on into a Word document, you know. And I sometimes, like, let's say I'm at hunting camp and I go out for a morning hunt or whatever, and we had a great time, and I'll come back and I'll have my computer there, and I'll write in, you know, during the hot part of the day or whatever. It's always best to get fresh, you know, stuff down when it's fresh. So there's a number of different ways things end up being written out. One of the things I found is that I'll just send myself voice notes, like either text myself or use a voice recorder if I'm driving or something like that. Just so I have at least the gist of what I think I want to write. But that said, I probably have 50 or more stories that are not finished or something like that. You know, I get started on them, but then something else comes up and I'm moving on to the next thing. And then a year or two later, I find I'm in my potentials folder, and I'm like, holy smokes, there's all these things in here. So,
yeah. Yeah. I like that. Longtime listeners of the show will know I can be a bit of a tech nerd with some stuff, and I'm just, as things change, you know, the voice recording and the transcription, and I've been doing some voice recordings in my truck when I finish a hunt. I've got this day one journal app that I use. Apple has a journal app on the iPhone, but I tried to use it this year. If I can try to stay in the same ecosystem, I like to, just so you don't have things all over the place, but early reports on that are not so great. So anyways, this day one journaling app works really well. You can audio record. It does limit you to 10 minutes, but I've gotten to like, okay, that's enough of a verbal, you know, download. And I just sort of talk about the hunt as I'm driving out usually on the gravel road or whatever, and putting it there. And I'm kind of trying to plan ahead to, you know, with the way that AI can summarize things. And if you have the transcription, you know, I'm envisioning like 10 years later, I'm like, hey, what was that one hunt I did with Hartley? You know, ask an AI, this kind of stuff. And it almost sounds kind of silly, but man, you know how memories are and how they tend to fade away. And I'm just trying to capture things, even if I don't necessarily have a plan to use them or anything like that. But
yeah, what, talking about being in the same ecosystem, I ended up getting a MacBook last December or something. I'd been a PC user for a long time, but I've had iPhones for a while now.
Yeah.
So it's really nice to have something that I can do a voice recording into, like on the Notes app or in a text message, and then I can get that text right into the computer and not have to translate it, you know, later on or whatever, just edit it.
Apple's pretty good about that.
Yeah.
getting you locked in. But I, for the same reason, I got a MacBook too, and I do appreciate those things, like the ease of syncing everything up. It's helpful because, again, if you're going too many different directions and not, you know, we got other stuff to do, it's just like things just get lost and they get squirreled away. And so if you can kind of keep track of them, it helps.
Yeah, for sure.
Talk to me a little bit about just, again, like the variety of hunting out there. How about you work in public lands. From a public lands perspective, typically Western states pretty good about having lots of opportunity. What are the programs out there? Do they have a private lands open to public access program? Are you mainly hunting public lands? What does it look like from a landscape perspective?
Yeah, so Washington has a good private lands access program. So there are a couple of different ways you can go about it, or the landowner, basically. The landowner can enroll in either feel free to hunt, which means anybody can go in anytime. A hunt by written permission, where the landowner or some designee has, actually writes out a permission slip, and you have to have that on you to be in there. And then there's a hunt by reservation, which is set up for whatever seasons are available and a limited number of people per hunt. So the hunter can go online, find where they want to go, get registered for, you know, whenever they want to be there. And then you have to have your registration on you and hunt that. Some of those properties, the reservation properties, can be some of the better ones. So it can be hard to get a reservation, but they can come in really clutch. Even when you think that, it's been pounded all season or whatever. Good sites are good sites regardless, you know? So I found that some of those are some of the best. I've also found that getting written permission on some of the hunt by written permission sites is really difficult.
Okay.
But there's, as far as public lands, Washington has a fair amount of Department of Natural Resources land and BLM scattered around. The Corps of Engineers has the Snake River Corridor. And that's some really good habitat. Those lands are mitigation lands for hunter and angler opportunity that came from Fish and Wildlife Coordination Act when the Lower Snake River dams were built. So they are wildlife lands in perpetuity. Good places to go. Mainly good grasslands and some shrub steppe in there. Some of those sites have some interesting riparian type habitats in them from intense irrigation, because they shouldn't be growing there. Otherwise, you know, it's dry land. But there's some neat properties out there. I spend a lot of my time on federal lands mainly, then whatever feel free to hunt properties I like. There's a lot of just like crop production land that's open to public, which isn't good for much. You know, it's just wheat stubble or what have you. Maybe there's some draws in there that are worth walking, but those lands get used pretty heavily, and if there is good bird cover in them, it's not extensive, so it gets hunted pretty hard and the birds can be pushed out.
All right, so then how do the bird, you know, earlier in the conversation you sort of laid out the different seasons and obviously the mixed bag opportunities. What is that? Are you going out and like forest grouse are usually kind of their own hunt, but what do you, you know, where do you find the valley quail specifically, and then what other kind of mixed bag hunts do you get into?
It's not unusual to be able to find pheasant, partridge, and Hungarian partridge and valley quail in the same covers. So I like to target, if I'm going to, let's say I really want to go for valley quail, I'm looking for tangly stuff. They like riparian areas too. They like blackberries. So I actually carry a pair of hand shears because dumping birds in the blackberries or whatever, they get really hard to retrieve. Fortunately, my youngest dog has decided she doesn't mind the brambles. She'll go in and take the thorns and grab birds and whatever else.
Do you get do you get bloody tails in the blackberries?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So blackberries and actually Russian olive thickets can get pretty heavy, and I've seen a bunch of quail in those things. Hunting kind of near riparian type stuff out in middle of nowhere is like sagebrush country. I've found quail, and they kind of sprinkle out into the sagebrush and whatnot, and that offers a unique and challenging hunt on its own. I could talk about that for a long time. It's just something else. How those birds act like desert birds, you know, they run and they scatter and they use the wind to their advantage and they fly 100 miles an hour. And, if I'm going to hunt Hungarian partridge, I will go a little bit higher. Like those birds come into, short grasslands and some of those little bit thicker covers for roost. But man, in just the barely the light of dawn, they will get up out of that stuff and go into wheat stubble. And I've seen more partridge in wheat stubble, you know, mid morning, than anything else. I've been lucky to have shot a few in the grasslands when I'm going after them. I think the last time I had a good hunt on Hungarian partridge, it was accidental because they were in the wheat stubble. My youngest dog, I think, pushed them all into the grassland while I wasn't paying attention. Like, I think she ran over a rise in the stubble as we were hiking into where I wanted to hunt, blew all the birds into the grassland, and then we went into the grass and found the birds. So that turned out better than expected for, cause I got to thinking back on it and flushing birds on the way out in the wheat. I'm like, I don't think the birds we got in the grass were actually there to start with. I think Zeta did that. Then, you know, the pheasant, they like the thicker stuff too. Where I hunt quail, there's always pheasant in there, but I've hunted pheasant all over in all different types of cover. And I actually like to look for them up and out of the drainages where it's a little bit sparser, because they'll go into the wheat stubble too, and they'll feed on the old grains and whatnot, and they come and loaf in the grasses, kind of like huns will.
Yeah. That seems like kind of the pointing dog guy's move to go find the pheasants in a little bit lighter cover if you can.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, no sharptails out there though?
So we have sharptails, but I think the last population estimate was like around 2,000 birds. We can't hunt them here. I actually volunteer with WDFW in the spring to do LEC surveys, and I've seen one or two birds every year, but that's it, like one or two. And they're wildfire and habitat fragmentation have been really hard on those birds.
Okay. Yeah, that reminds me, there was a whole segment or two in the book about your sort of trek to North Dakota to try to go find sharptails. And yeah, it was we don't need to go into the whole story, but I enjoyed that one. It was maybe not the way you dreamed about it, but it was an adventure nonetheless, right?
It was an adventure. I need to get back there and see if I can have a shot at North Dakota in a bit of a different environmental scenario there, you know?
Yeah.
But it was nice to have stumbled into those birds in Montana on the way home.
Yeah, no doubt. The other thing I think about, it's like the mixed bag thing. It's just always, it's so intriguing to me when I talk to Western hunters and other people that obviously I've been hunting rough grouse for a long time, and I don't really get tired of that. You know, I love just hiking through the woods and exploring new places and all that kind of stuff. But the thought of like waking up and like, which bird am I going to go after today? That's just so intriguing to me. Is there a bird that you are like particularly fascinated with right now, or like, how do you decide?
I think right now it is sagebrush cover and hunting quail that really speaks to me, because it's a challenging hunt, but I really like that landscape. I'm a big sagebrush fan, and I really love covey birds. You know, I got started thinking pheasant were king, and I've really slacked off on pheasant hunting because I think covey birds are more fun. So right now it's valley quail that speak most to me, but I think I mentioned earlier, I got to remind myself to go hunt grouse because I'm really enjoying that too.
Yeah. What's a typical valley quail covey? They're the ones that they can be in really big groups, can't they?
Yeah. It kind of depends on the time of the year. We've been in, I would say the last 3 or 4 years even have been really good valley quail years. And I've see, the coveys I was seeing the other weekend, I know 60 plus birds in a covey. Here at my house, I've got valley quail all the time, and I've seen as many as about 100 birds at one time in a good year.
Wow. Yeah, that's a big group.
Yeah, and it's definitely one of those things where when you hunt them enough, you understand their behavior. It's you hold your fire on that initial covey flush, because you know 2/3 of the covey is going to get up and go at once, but you'll okay. have the stragglers, and so okay. you wait on that second and third and even fourth flushes. Like I've shot quail, and you know, dump both barrels, reload and keep standing there, and more birds will come out. You know, if it's a big enough covey, and just keep patient, there'll be plenty yeah. of birds in there.
Keep patient and keep walking.
Yeah. Yeah. I've not cool. seen that on Hungarian partridge though. My experience,
they all seem to get out of there right at once.
When the Huns get up, they all get up and go.
Yeah. That is interesting, because that's obviously the, you know, sharp tails are similar. The everybody talks about the staggered flush, and that I've definitely seen that play out. You know, there's usually one or two behind, but there's also not typically 100. I guess later in the season, you see some big groups of sharp tails, but yeah, I love it. Well, shoot, man, this has been a blast. I really, really enjoyed speaking with you. Really enjoyed the book. Encourage listeners to check that out, Wing Shooting the Palouse. And I'm excited to hear that there's another one in the works. I would ask you to please keep me in the loop on that. If there's anything I can help with, or would love to get you back on when it's ready to go and ready to read, I'd love to help you out with that too.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. I appreciate you having me on and appreciate your support.
All right, buddy. Say the website, it's your name, but where can folks go to read a little bit more, and then best place to go to get the book?
Yeah, so it's probably easiest just to find the book on Amazon. You can just yeah. search Wing Shooting the Palouse, it'll pop right up. My website's bradfrembo.com. I don't update it as frequently as I should, but I'm trying to put more of some of the stuff I generally publish, throw that into the post page, so you know, can share that with a broader audience.
Yeah, good deal, man. Well, like I said, I really enjoyed it. I will drop some links in the show notes to all that stuff, and the book is available, and we'll be anxiously awaiting book number two. But I wish you the best of luck this fall, and let's keep in touch, my friend.
Yeah, likewise, Nick. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for joining me on this episode of the Birdshot Podcast. Hey, everyone. It's your host, Nick, here. One more thing before you go. Thanks for joining us on this episode of the Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt. Be sure to subscribe and follow the show so you don't miss our next episode. And if you really love the show and want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, you can do so by joining our Patreon community. Click the link in the show notes to this episode. You can sign up for as little as $5 a month. And if you do, I will send you some of these Birdshot Podcast can coolers and stickers as a thank you for doing so. Thanks, everyone. Catch you on the next episode of the Birdshot Podcast.